Lecture 17. Marathon. End of the First Persian Invasion.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. I said in our last lecture that I wanted to talk a little more about Herodotus in this lecture. I want to do so not just because he's the major source for the Persian Wars, but because he's pivotal in the development of Greek historiography, another product of the archaic period. In fact, he's commonly called the father of history, so we're meeting yet another father in this course. So I'll say a few words about him now before moving on to discuss the Battle of Marathon, which is the core of this lecture. Herodotus was a Greek from Halicarnassus in Caria, and he is commonly called the father of history, as I said, since he was the first to write serious researches. The title of his work, Historiae, means researches, and it's usually translated as histories. The work he wrote is not merely a blow-by-blow account of the Persian Wars, however, for Herodotus was keen to try to find out how the war between Persia and Greece, or East versus West, arose. And in doing so, he goes back to the time of the Trojan War. And he's not alone in thinking that the origins of the later Persian Wars lie with the Trojan. It's no coincidence that on the later Parthenon in Athens, one of the reliefs shows the Greeks battling the Trojans. And this is meant to evoke Greek versus Persians in the Persian Wars. Herodotus is therefore fashioning later Greeks, as well as us, to see these Persian Wars as perhaps inevitable, and is reinforcing the need to know our history and to understand, and I mean really understand, not think you do, the differences in culture, religion, and beliefs. This is a lesson that applies to us now, and certain events in the past few decades could have been handled very differently if people had really known their history, especially when it came to the importance of religious differences. Because Herodotus is dealing with a large time span, much of his work consists of digressions about persons, places, and things, because he made his living out of reciting his work. And so he needed to keep the interest level of his audience high. For example, his work is divided into 9 books, and the entire second book can be called a digression, since it deals exclusively with the customs and history of Egypt from the days of the pharaohs. Herodotus believed in the traditional gods, and he puts forward supernatural explanations for why things happened. To Herodotus, for example, a drought had nothing to do with the natural disaster of no rain, but it was a punishment from the gods. Nevertheless, his work is distinguished from the previous poets or chroniclers who merely told stories because Herodotus tries to get at the truth. He went to Egypt, for example, because he tells us how important personal observation was to him, rather than relying on hearsay. And in his quest for truth and information about Egypt, he goes to the priests first, because they kept the most accurate records. Herodotus' account of the events of the Persian Wars is generally reliable because he lived through them, although he probably wrote about them in the middle of the 5th century when he might not have remembered things quite so sharply. That's why some of the things he says have to be taken with a pinch of salt. For example, his use of numbers, and his accounts of battles are sometimes confused and inaccurate. We'll comment on this sort of stuff when and where it's relevant. But now let's get back to the history. The Ionian Revolt of 499 to 494 had been at best a gallant failure, but it had shown 3 things. First, that Persian power, long regarded as invincible, could be countered, if only for a while. Second, the importance of fleets in naval warfare, for the revolt ended at the decisive Battle of Lade. And 3, the need for unity in resisting a common foe. Herodotus believed that disunity among the Greeks at Lardae was the reason for their defeat. Now, this disunity should not come as a surprise, given what we know about how Greeks felt towards each other. This feeling of xenophobia that was as much part and parcel of the polis system as autonomy, as in their desire for freedom. But it's surprising to us when we consider that the Greeks were facing a threat that affected all of them. But at the end of the day, these differences still ruled. You would expect common unity, but there wasn't. Anyway, as we said last time, in 490, a Persian fleet of 600 ships and 20,000 men, according to Herodotus, sailed to Greece. So the warfare has begun. The number of ships may be a bit on the high side, but the number of men might be about right. After some initial pillaging and looting along the way, at the island of Naxos, for example, the Persians arrived at Eretria on the island of Euboea, that island that is to the east of central Greece, and the Persians besieged the city of Eretria itself. The Eretrians appealed for help to the Athenians, and this was granted. Now, the Athenian commitment to help the Eretrians was not so much because the Athenians were staunch allies of them, but because they realized they were going to be next. And you could almost jump from Euboea to the coastline of eastern Attica anyway, so it was imperative to try to stop the Persians at Eretria before they might move on to Athens. Well, despite the Athenian help, Eretria fell after a seven-day siege. The Persians then burned the city temples, and I'd reckon a goodly number of houses too, in revenge for the burning of Sardis in 498, during the Ionian Revolt. It's hardly surprising that there was panic in Athens when the Persians left Euboea and crossed to land at Marathon in eastern Attica. It's now about September of 490, by the way. Marathon was the place where Pisistratus landed in 545 after his self-imposed exile in Thrace. From Marathon, he defeated the army of the nobles at Pallene and went on to seize Athens, as we know. That particular incident, plus the fact that Hippias, the son of Pisistratus, was part of the Persian contingent that landed at Marathon, would probably, to the Athenians, make it seem as though history was about to be repeated. In other words, that Pisistratus had marched on Athens and seized power, and now his son, albeit, what, in his 70s or 80s by now, was about to do the same, this time with Persian backing. So the Athenians mobilized an army, and they sent a certain Pheidippides to run to Sparta, pleading for immediate help. This made sense, since Sparta, as we know, had the strongest and best-trained land army on the Greek mainland. Now, Herodotus says that Pheidippides arrived in Sparta the next day. Now, he's really motoring, because the distance between Athens and Sparta is over 100 miles. It would take me a day just to run 100 feet. The Athenian appeal for help to Sparta made sense, as I said, given the size and power of the Spartan army. However, the Spartans refused an immediate deployment of men, and their reason was that they were celebrating a religious festival in honor of Apollo. They couldn't interrupt this until it ended the night of the full moon. That was only a day or two away anyway. To put it on hold, in other words, to put the festival on hold, would upset the god. And given what we've said about the piety of the Greeks, this is not something that any Greek would want to do, upset the gods, that is. So on the one hand, the excuse is plausible. But on the other hand, if Darius did intend to conquer all of Greece, and we talked about this last time, we might expect Apollo to understand that the Spartans needed to interrupt his festival for a while, no offense intended, of course, to Apollo, and then resume the festivities when they'd helped to save the Greeks. Otherwise, Greece might fall to Persia, And then where would Apollo be? The Spartans would have been aware of this, so their unwillingness to commit a force as soon as they received the Athenian appeal for help is very odd. Unless, that is, and unless is heavily underlined here, unless they were having a problem with the Helots, and they didn't want the Athenians, or indeed the rest of the Greeks, to know about this. And so they were using the festival as an excuse. Now, you're probably thinking by now that I see Helots to blame for everything, that I see Helots hiding behind every lamppost. But we cannot rule them out of the Spartans' decision here because it is such an odd one, given how critical the period is. The Persians are on Greek soil, and the Spartans are not marching to assist the Athenians against the Persians. That's odd. In the end, only a small force of Plataeans, Plataea is in Boeotia, march with the Athenian hoplites to Marathon. Now, there's no question that if people had been taking bets on which side would win, the Athenians would have had really long odds. Remember, this is the Persian cavalry and infantry we're talking about. It was probably around 20,000 in number, and it was facing the relatively inexperienced, hastily formed Athenian and Plataean hoplite force. No cavalry, and probably only 10,000 soldiers, perhaps even less. So this coalition was easily outnumbered by the Persians. Now, isn't it only in the movies that the hero underdog wins out in the end against his or her superior enemy? Could Bruce Lee really defeat those 50 guys in real life if they all attacked him at the same time? Actually, he probably could. The Athenian Polymarchos at Marathon was a chap called Callimachus. But also present were the 10 strategoi, those professional generals instituted by Cleisthenes, remember, in 508. So Marathon was really the first major test of these new officials. The problem was too many cooks spoil the broth. Some of the 10 generals had very different ideas from the others about strategy. Half were in favor of waiting for the full moon when the Spartan festival to Apollo would end and the Spartan promise of help was supposed to arrive. The other half of the strategoi wanted to attack sooner, perhaps to try and catch the Persians unawares. And then there was the Callimachus factor as well, as I call it, because he was Polymarchos, he was the Polymarch Archon, and that meant that he was commander-in-chief. He did have authority over the 10 strategoi. Which side would he go with? In the end, the strategos Miltiades was allowed to plan the strategy and direct operations. And because of this, he won Marathon for the Athenians. Miltiades was a member of the Philiade family, one of the oldest and wealthiest in Athens. In fact, he was a nephew of the Miltiades that was sent by Pisistratus as governor of the Thracian Chersonese region back in 545. And Miltiades the nephew had lived up in the Thracian Chersonese for some time as well before he returned to Athens. He got back to Athens in about 493. So 3 years later, we find him strategos and ready to play an integral part in Athenian military affairs. So how did he wrest control from Callimachus and the other strategoi and direct the Athenians and Plataeans to attack as they did? Well, what he did was to make an impassioned speech to Callimachus, which Herodotus gives us, or at least he gives us his version of it. In this speech, Miltiades urged Callimachus to attack the Persians immediately. He said that the fate of Athens and Greece was in Callimachus's hands, and that if he kept dilly-dallying, the Greeks as a whole would lose faith and they would submit to the Persians and it would all be over. But, says Miltiades, with the gods' help, they would win the battle. All of this depends on you, says Miltiades to Callimachus, according to Herodotus, that is. All of this depends on you. It hangs on your decision now. So this is really putting Callimachus on the spot. And Callimachus folded. And perhaps he folded because he was influenced to a very large extent by another line that Miltiades ran. Herodotus says that Miltiades said to him, Callimachus, in your hands right now is the means to make Athens enslaved or free, and to leave to all mankind forever a memorial to yourself, the sort that not even Harmodius and Aristogiton left. And we know the symbolism of their act, don't we, in bringing about an end to the Pisistrated tyranny. Miltiades arranged the Greek line with Callimachus commanding the right flank. Aristides and Themistocles, we'll be talking more about those two in a couple of minutes, Aristides and Themistocles were in charge of the center, and the Plataean allies were on the left flank of the Greek line. Miltiades had deliberately made both flanks deeper, both flanks of the phalanx deeper, in other words, more men there, even though this meant weakening the center of the line. And the reason why he did this was that the flanks would have so much more weight in them from the massed hoplite infantry that they would just smash into the Persian line, and then they would wheel around it and come behind it so that the Persians, in effect, would be cut off in between all the Greeks. They would be facing Greeks on all sides, in effect. Now, arranging the Greek line in an equal depth throughout, in other words, if he hadn't made the flanks heavier, if he'd had a standard formation whereby the line was stretched frontally and it was all the same depth, that might look nicer on postcards, but it wouldn't be heavy enough to penetrate the Persian line. So Miltiades, therefore, was placing all his hopes on his flanks, smashing the Persian line and getting behind it. Miltiades was also hoping, gambling maybe, that the hoplites' longer spears would also hurt the Persian line, because the Persians didn't have this sort of weaponry. They didn't have these longer spears that the hoplites did. So that gave the Greeks an advantage there. What they did have, though, that's the Persians. What the Persians did have was archers. And Miltiades knew that these would wreak havoc among the Greeks. But the Persian archers needed to stop, to reload, to drop onto one knee, and then fire their bows. So he may well have ordered the Greeks to march against the enemy, to march against the Persian line, and when the Persian archers dropped down on one knee to fire, then the Greeks probably stopped, locked their shields over their bodies, so that the arrows from the Persians clattered harmlessly on them. Repeat this step until you get close enough to the enemy line to charge it and then smash it. According to Herodotus, the Greeks, whose camp, by the way, was on a hillside overlooking the plain, the Greeks ran down this hillside and charged at the Persians for a mile before the two sides clashed together. Now, the Greeks, as we know, were hoplite soldiers. So running in the full heavy armor for this distance is perhaps too implausible. Plus, they would have been mown down by the Persian archers anyway. So more probably, the Greeks advanced fairly quickly against the Persians, like you see those people power walking today. They probably power walked towards the Persians. They stopped whenever Persian arrows came towards them. They locked their shields over their heads so that they weren't hurt by the Persian arrows. And then for those last few hundred feet, they charged as hard as they could. At any rate, the heavier flanks were able to smash the Persian line, and the battle turned into fierce hand-to-hand fighting. Now, before I talked about Persian infantry and cavalry, and you're probably wondering, what is the cavalry doing? Well, we'll talk about that in a second, if I may. To everyone's surprise, and I'm sure everyone's surprise, including probably the Athenians and the Plataeans, the Greeks defeated the Persians. And the Persians scrambled back onto their ships and cast off as quickly as they could. The story goes that even then the Greeks didn't want to let them go. They wanted to keep inflicting casualties on the Persian side. Aeschylus' brother, the tragic playwright Aeschylus, his brother apparently only let go of one of the Persian ships when his arm was chopped off by a Persian axe. So Marathon was a Persian rout. Aeschylus' brother was obviously armless enough. To an extent, the Persians' ineptitude had contributed to their defeat because they hadn't reconnoitred the territory properly. The plain of Marathon had a good deal of swampy ground. A lot of plains do, don't they, where the plain hits the water? Swampy ground. And the Persians had disembarked their cavalry onto it. Bogged down as the cavalry became, it was rendered ineffective. Horses really aren't very good on swampy terrain. And that's why Marathon was an infantry engagement, not a cavalry one. In all likelihood, the outcome would have been very different had the Persian cavalry operated properly, because the Persian cavalry was first rate. So infantry wasn't. Persian infantry wasn't great, but that cavalry, goodness me. So the Persians then contribute to their defeat at Marathon because they landed the cavalry where it couldn't be deployed. That was the edge that Miltiades needed. At the same time, we mustn't begrudge the Athenians their victory. Although the Persian army was not on home soil, it had been beaten. Herodotus says that 6,400 Persians had been killed, but only 192 Athenians. And the Athenian dead included Callimachus, the Polemarchus Archon. This is quite a ratio, 192 to 6,400. And Herodotus must be exaggerating the Persian numbers for rhetorical effect. He favours the Athenians anyway. It's interesting that Herodotus says nothing about the number of Plataeans who died. And some of them must have. But Herodotus turns the battle into a uniquely Athenian victory. He's not diluting the Athenian numbers, by the way, as the Athenians cremated the remains of those who died in the battle. Then they buried them under a commemorative mound on the battlefield itself. And they put a list of their names next to it. And that mound is still there today. You can still see it today on Marathon Plain. Now, news of the Athenians' victory was taken to the city from Marathon by Pheidippides. He obviously did a heck of a lot of running in those days. He ran all the way from Marathon to Athens, a little over 20 miles. And so we have the origins and the distance of the modern marathon race. This is where it all starts. In the 1996 Athens Olympics, the marathon race, by the way, was extended, I believe, ever so slightly so that the marathon runners could run round the Marathon Monument, the Battle of Marathon Monument that I was just talking about. Now, it was customary on the part of the victor to dedicate spoils from battles to the gods, and Miltiades was no different. He dedicated his spoils to Zeus at Olympia. And these can be seen in the fantastic museum at Olympia today. It's a great museum. Everybody should see it. Now, included among the spoils that he dedicated to Zeus was his armor, his helmet, and it had his name inscribed on it. That's how we know it's Miltiades. And as you look on the helmet today, when you go to the museum, you could look at his name clearly written on it. History's coming alive again. Just imagine standing next to a glass display cabinet, and you're only a few inches away from what's inside that cabinet. And inside that glass display cabinet is Miltiades' helmet. It's incredibly moving when you see that name incised on it, to think that the man who defeated the Persians at Marathon that day put it on his head and then dedicated it to the gods. It's just history, as I say, just comes alive when these things happen. And it's okay to get goosebumps. So then, the invincible Persian army had been beaten by the Greek hoplite army. Well, the Athenians and the Plataeans, that is. And to use the modern parlance, that was huge. The Battle of Marathon became one of the most significant events in Athenian history for what it symbolized and how it came to be portrayed. because it came to be portrayed as an Athenian victory that saved Greece. Forget the role of the Plataeans in it. The battle also gives us a new Greek word. There's a new word that now comes into Greek vocabulary, Marathon Omakoi, the fighters at Marathon. These men were regarded as heroes, and they were. And long after they were dead, their memories were invoked in political and judicial speeches, for example, as examples of patriots who stood firm against a barbarian foe. How everyone should be like them. And I'm going to pick up on this point in a two or three lectures time when we complete our analysis of the archaic period and go on to the classical. We'll revisit Marathon at that time. I see Marathon as Athens' coming of age as a military power. This is not something, though, that would have gone down well with the Spartans, would it? They did send help when their festival to Apollo ended, but it arrived too late. It actually arrived the day after the Battle of Marathon, which for me is the time I would want to arrive at a battle. But inwardly, the Spartans must have been miffed at the result. I mean, they might boast the toughest and best-trained army on the Greek mainland, and they did head the Peloponnesian League and had done since the middle of the 6th century. They did have this international reputation. We saw how Croesus of Lydia wanted Spartan help in defying the great king. But now, the Athenians had defeated the Persian army and on Greek soil. This is something the Spartans hadn't done. And nobody would have expected the Athenians to do this either. The underdog has really shone here. So, this Athenian victory at Marathon would not have sat well with the Spartans, not by a long chalk. And so we move from Athens as a growing economic and cultural center. Remember, both of these things Sparta was not. We move then from Athens as this growing economic and cultural center to Athens as a growing military power with distinguished hoplites, Marathon Omakoi. And the Athenians relished this, as can be seen in the new air of confidence in the city. Just 3 years later, in 487, they held their first ostracism, for example. In the meantime, the Persians had scarpered out of Greece, their tails between their legs, or rather their tails between the sterns of their ships. And so ends 490, with the Athenians euphoric and everyone talking about these Marathon Omakoi. And so they should. This was a massive achievement on the part of the Athenians. As I said, if we were betting people, we would have made a fortune that day by betting on the Athenians. But the big questions now are two or three. First, what would Darius do next? Was he simply going to allow his Persian troops to have been defeated on the Greek mainland and say, okay, well, there's nothing else I can do now, I'm not going back in there? Or, second question, when would he come back if he wasn't going to allow the Persian defeat at Marathon to pass without some form of retribution? Well, he wouldn't actually do anything himself, because Darius died in 486 BC, and the Persian throne then passed to his son Xerxes. This is the famous Xerxes of the later Persian Wars era. Now, Xerxes was faced with all sorts of problems when he first became king, and we'll talk about those in the next lecture. But Xerxes would launch a massive invasion of Greece in 481. It was huge. He led something like 200,000 troops. And this was a revenge mission for the Persians being defeated at Marathon. Make no bones about it. In the previous lecture, we talked about whether Darius' aim was simply punitive against Athens and Eretria, or whether he intended to conquer all of Greece. Well, Xerxes intended to conquer all of Greece. And we'll discuss his invasion in our next lecture. Thank you very much.